Welcome to the Assistant Lab podcast, hosted by Victoria Ratton and Arnel Martin.
This podcast is dedicated to the executive assistant profession, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
We've created this podcast for the outliers, the linchpins, the assistants who are serious about their careers. This is a podcast for those who are preparing for the future today.
This is a space for no-nonsense content, benchmarking and tracking industry and world trends, as well as interesting interviews with exceptionally inspirational people. The goal here is to stimulate new ways of thinking and being in this profession.
So, on with the show.
It's great to be back with the next episode of the Assistant Lab. Now, we have taken another little mini break in between this episode and the last, and that is because we got a lot of feedback and private messages, emails and comments about our last interview, which was with Jess from the assistant room. And we're delighted that it's struck a chord with so many people. We knew that we had touched up on some very controversial points as far as the rest of the industry was concerned. But we really did feel that these things needed to be said, and it was about time. And so we've just been sort of processing all the messages we've been receiving and the feedback. And again, thank you for those of you that got in touch about the topics that we covered. You know, Anel and I didn't set up this podcast because we were trying to make money out of sponsorship. We don't accept any sponsors on this podcast. We just wanted a safe space for us to be able to talk about the things that the industry's never really allowed us to talk about. And we always say to our speakers and everybody that we interview, you can say what the hell you want, frankly. And so today's guest is an absolutely incredible person. Ruth Kyler is an Australian trainer, coach, speaker, all-round, absolutely phenomenal person. And again, we touch upon some of the topics that we covered in the last episode, and we also get Ruth's perspective of this. She has had a sensational career background. What I really admire about her is the shrewdness and how strategic she's been with the moves she's made in her career in setting up a business. And frankly, there's some sound nuggets in this episode for sure that every single EA needs to hear. This episode's a little bit longer than our last, so you might want to do this over two dog walks or in your break times whenever you get them. But as I always say, sit back, grab a coffee, bottle of water, or even a glass of wine, and enjoy. Ruth, I'm so excited. Welcome to the Assistant Lab. We've across three time zones, three different accents today. This is awesome. Like, welcome. Good evening to you. Good morning to us. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
And how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good. And is it summer? My cousin lives in Australia now. She moved there a couple of years ago and she said she's never coming back here. But the weather, like, it's summer. Is it summer now in Australia?
You're heading into
end of spring, starting to be summer. Yeah. So it's springtime, it's like all the seasons in one week.
Every day. Yeah.
Well, I'm jealous right about now because Ruth, you did live in the UK, and I know you'll probably talk a little bit about that. But it's winter here and we had a storm and part of my roof blew off yesterday. So
oh my goodness.
Yeah. No flooding or anything, we're fine. But it's situation normal here. A storm every week in the UK, as they say. Okay, right. We like to go kind of back to teenage years, find out what you were thinking, Ruth. Did you want to be an astronaut? What did you want to do? What were you thinking career-wise? I did have in my head to be a secretary at a very young age, but I did think about other professions as well. Yeah, I was about 12 when when it became noticeable to me as a profession, and I was like, oh, quite. But I did think about, I wanted to be a police officer for a short time as well.
I did at some stage as well. I think all kids.
Yeah. Well, I've got to say that the first memory I have of thinking what I want to be for a living, I was probably six and I saw the Big Shop Dolls and I wanted to dress the Big Shop Dolls. Now, Vic, you'll know what my fashion sense is like. heaven forbid I should ever dress shop dolls. So good thing that didn't pan out.
So what was going on with Teenage Ruth then? What were you thinking?
Oh, my goodness. I grew up in a small town, small country town south of Sydney in Australia. And look, I definitely didn't aspire to be in the admin profession at a young age. I didn't really know what I wanted. And, you know, I throughout my career, I never really knew what I wanted. But my father was an entrepreneur, serial entrepreneur. Yeah. And so I observed and watched him and was obviously involved in several of, you know, taking money from tills and stuff from several of his businesses. So, you know, he was very much a strong role model for me growing up. And I went through high school. I was never the popular kid or the kid that got the highest marks, but I wasn't, you know, at the bottom either, you know, in terms, I just kind of went through school. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. But at the end of high school, so here in Australia, it's year 12, I decided to take a gap year. I took a year off, and both my parents are English. So I took a year off and went overseas, and I've got quite extensive family over there. So I managed, it pretty much took me an entire year to go around the entire UK and a bit of Europe as well, visiting all my family, which was so much fun, you know, being a 19-year-old back then, you know, taking a year off and just traveling, but also spending time with family and meeting them. So that was really lovely. Prior to taking the gap year, I had secured a spot at university. It was a business management degree in tourism and hospitality. So, I took that gap year off, and when I came back, went to university from there. So that, like, I'd say I went to a business degree or business management degree in tourism. It was kind of what I was like, you know, I'll go into that. That will be a good general, you know, degree to go into. I don't know if that's something I want to do forever or, you know, that I'll end up doing at the end. It was kind of an interest thing rather than that's my life passion. Yeah. So that's how essentially, I mean, I was never the naughty kid. And growing up, but I was always interested in watching people and people. And people have been a significant role in my life, whether it's my parents tell me the story, especially my father, that when I was a child, they would frequently lose me in the crowd. And it wasn't because I had run off or walked off. It was because I had just stood still. I hadn't walked with them. And my dad used to say, well, if I just retrace my steps, I would always find you in the spot I used to be standing, you know, a couple of hundred meters back. And I would always just be, he'd find me standing there, staring at people, watching people, captivated and mesmerized by people, movement, conversations. So this story now resonates into what I do now is incredible. Watching people, listening to people every day is that. So that story to this day makes such an impact in terms of the person I am today. Absolutely.
Foundation.
So that was in terms of the junior Ruth, my story. And from university, it was a three-year degree, and the last kind of 6 months of the degree was internship. And I had such a fabulous time in the UK, you know, the years prior. I was like, I'm going to go back. And I did. I took off, and I said to Mum and Dad, I'll be back in 2 years. Poor things. It was 8 years, not 2 years. It took 8 years living in the UK. I absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. And without doubt, one of the best decisions of my life in terms of personal growth. And, you know, you really mature as an individual when you start to travel, especially living by yourself in a foreign country and, you know, and making a new life for yourself and starting a new career, essentially. So I loved it. I really loved it. And I was working at the time, I was working in a sales, reservation sales role for Intercontinental Hotels Group. So Intercontinental on Park Lane. It was an amazing role. It was fantastic, really big eye-opener. And about a year and a half into that role, I was, 19, 20. And I remember someone coming to me and they're like, oh, Ruth, the hotel's half of it's shutting down for renovation. Your role's going to be made redundant. And I remember thinking to myself, what's that? I was totally new to the employment space. And they said, no, we're just going to pay you a bit of money and you'll be losing your role. And I was like, how much money? And this is, being a 20-year-old, I remember thinking, this is fantastic. So off I went and traveled around Europe for 4 months. So I thought it was fantastic. So I always joke about my career pretty much started with a role being made redundant and ended with my role being made redundant, which is quite a story, nice way to tie it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is such a fabulous story. I love it.
Yeah, so I loved it, and that's that then brings me beautifully back to after 4 months of travel around Europe, came back to London and thought, what next? And that was the beginning of me stepping into the professional admin space from that point.
So what was your first sort of admin assistant role? Well, as you say, it was in London.
Yeah, well, because I had previously worked in reservation sales, I'd realised, I didn't have any admin space. But the reason I just wanted to go into corporate is that I was working in hotels, which can be a lot of shift work all over the place. And I was like, you know what, I want something more 9-to-5 structured. I mean, I laugh at that now. And I was like, I don't have any experience. You know what, I'm just going to go into some temp roles. Again, another fantastic decision I made in my career, because I was able to go from a switchboard operating role then into a receptionist role. And within 6 months of stepping into the professional admin space, went into EA to CEO role, which was frightening. And I backed myself, but I was definitely very overwhelmed in that role, and it was sink or swim. But I, to this day, if anyone ever asked me how to quickly move into an EA to achieve a C-suite role, I said, get into temping contract work. And there's so many benefits to that. And I know in the United Kingdom, it's a different market to other countries, especially if you're in the UK, anyone listening in the UK, if you want to climb the corporate ladder, get into temping or contract work and quickly climb. You can very quickly climb. And I want to say about 90% of roles that I was had temporary assignments offered me full-time roles. So I know the market now. Industry is changing, the changing times at the moment, but it was a very smart decision on my behalf without realizing it.
Yeah.
Until I was in it. So I went into an EA to CEO role after many different contracting roles. I was working for a large international accounting and consultancy network, RSM International. Mm-hmm. And I worked for that organization for 6 years. And I was also supporting the international board. This was an amazing role, and I learned so much from that executive. And to this day, it's one of the most notable partnerships I had, purely because I learned so much from her, and about business, how to show up, how to present yourself, how to hold, really high-level conversations, how to network, a high level of the quality of work that I was delivering and the standard at which I was delivering as well. So I learned a lot in that role, and I'm forever grateful. And from that within that role, 6 years, I went into a stakeholder relations role. So I moved out of the EA to CEO role. That was around the 6 year mark. From my research, around the 6-7 year mark, something happens within the EA space, and there's a 7 year itch for sure. Which I find fascinating. I've done quite a bit of research with a lot of assistants, and it's around that time that I was just at the point where I had suffered a bit of burnout in my role, but I was wanting something different and wanting to grow, and it made sense for me to, because I was already working with all the board members. I had a strong connection network within the entire network, and everyone knew me, to move into a stakeholder relations role. So that's what I did for about a year and a half, and then decided it was time to move home to Australia. So it was a hard decision to leave the UK. And from that, when I got back into Australia, moved into G Australia and then New Zealand, which was, again, an amazing organisation to work for. Yeah. A very deliberate move. A lot of people said to me, well, why have you been from, EA to CEO, and then you took a step down, and I went into GE as EA to the CFO and Vice President of Communications at the time. And it was, again, a really grateful move that I did in terms of a step down. I'm doing some air quotes here, guys. That I hear a lot from assistants that feel that if it's a step down, that they're not progressing, which is not the case.
No.
I wanted to go wide. I wanted to have access to different departments, functions, and different projects available to me. And I knew walking into General Electric, Australia and New Zealand, at the time, the organisation was significantly larger than it is today here in Australia, and I knew the opportunities would be vast in comparison to maybe another organisation. So I love that. I love working there, absolutely loved it, and I was involved in so many projects that I started myself and led myself, and I, without doubt, was asked a number of times. There was a CEO switchover. I was invited to apply for those roles to support the CEO, and decline those offers. Why, Ruth? Because I want to work within the business and not at such a high level. So it was interesting watching other leaders not understand that I was wanting to grow my business acumen. I was really wanting to go wide and understand the business more. And without doubt, another great decision on my behalf that I don't
regret. I totally get that.
1 ounce.
Totally. You mentioned this step down. I had a similar experience in my life where I was working for very senior management in an organization of 20,000 people. When I was reassigned into a different business unit, I took a job. I could have worked for the chairman of the board, or I could have worked for a group executive. I picked the group executive for many of the same reasons you mentioned.
Yeah.
But also, if you've gone through a burnout episode, it's almost as if you think, this is what I can manage now. This is where I can apply my talents in a sustainable way. And like you said, growing that business acumen on the side. The division I ended up in was incredibly interesting to me, and I could stick my fingers in all kinds of pies. It wasn't that sense of isolation that I had in the more senior offices, almost as if you're in a bubble. It's as if your immediate team just feels smaller, and you feel like you've got less access. So that totally, totally resonates. And I do think sometimes it's an ego thing where people think it's a step down. Sometimes it's the smartest decision you can make.
That's exactly what I was thinking, because I was EA to CEO of a disability charity, and I'm thinking Ruth and I probably walked past each other in London at that time.
I love that idea.
You probably did. It's like sliding doors. And then I went to Hays, which is a massive FTSE 250 company here, and I went to work for the group HR director, and somebody said to me at the time, why have you gone from CEO to a group HRD? And I'm like, well, I want exposure to HR, and I want to learn more about that part of the business. And I liked what he, my HR director, was pitching about what how we were going to work together and what it was going to look like, because he was new to Hays as well. And he's like, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And I was like, yeah, I want in on that. And then I had just over 7 years at Hays before I got the 7 year itch.
The 7 year itch. I do think there's something in that, Ruth. That is so funny that you mentioned.
Yeah, it's honestly fascinating.
People I talk to. And we always used to joke, the senior EAs in my company, we used to joke that it becomes like a bad marriage at that point. You know? So I think as much as you grow into that relationship, sometimes it's just feeling like you need to expand beyond. Because I think at that 7 year mark, it starts becoming quite settled. And people who really are high achieving are always looking for a challenge. There's only so much challenge you can create. So I think there is kind of a ceiling where you need to take on something new.
Yeah. I was in that pretty much when I got into GE, it was almost instantaneous with it. Cause I mean, I walked into that first role. It was actually a temporary cover. And so I brought that with me from my learnings from London I walked into an issue with, you know, invoicing. Back then it was a physical part of invoicing, and their accounts payable system was just really clunky. And I just made it my mission to learn this tool because I needed to process all the invoices, and cut a long story short, became the go-to expert in the entire business to how to navigate it and I taught other people how to use it because I became an expert at it. And I started doing ad hoc random projects, including, you know, anytime I saw a problem, like, for example, there was, you know, a General Electric US-based intranet, but not a local, you know, regional one in Australia, which frustrated to me no end. But then there was always people coming to me and asking from the two teams I was supporting, they were asking me the repetitive same questions. And I was like, this is just driving me nuts, you know, this is a waste of my time. So I ended up creating with another assistant what's called, I don't know if they still got it today, called Admin Guru, which was an intranet, internal intranet that had access to common resources. And instead of then sending people emails of resource or links, Admin Guru. Yeah. And it's changed people's behavior. It was brilliant. And I remember not long before I left GE, someone telling me, they're like, oh, you just go to Admin Guru, you can get it from that. Someone telling me where to go. Like, I'm like, oh, well, this is working. So I was always getting involved in little projects. And then towards the end of my career as an assistant, I was covering for another assistant. It was the EA to the CEO. She and I had a really great working relationship, and we would cover for each other. And she was on holiday, and I was stepping in to help on leadership team meeting. And that particular meeting that I was in, I overheard a conversation about a new project initiative which would utilize, you know, employees within GE to work on business issues and business problems. And as a, you know, a business development exercise for employees, engagement exercise, but also a business benefit as well. And they were talking in this meeting about, you know, a marketing manager or, you know, a business development manager running this project. And I was like, hang on. That I could do that, you know. Anyway, so I sat quietly in this meeting and I waited until just listening. And after the meeting had finished, I quickly ran the hallway and tapped that executive on the shoulder who was leading this initiative. And I said, look, that proposal you put forward for that project, you know, I don't know if you consider an assistant for that position. If so, I would like to put myself forward. And he said, I didn't even think of an assistant.
Wow.
That were the exact words. I didn't even think of an assistant. Ruth, you'd be perfect. You know, please you can have it, you know, absolutely put yourself forward. And that was the start of a truly unique and incredible experience for me, because I was leading business improvement processes for GE Electric Australia and New Zealand. So I was the CEO's liaison and executing strategic business projects. So I was liaising with all the business leaders, recruiting teams from across Australia and New Zealand on these business projects, which were housed in war rooms for over 2 weeks, and they would pitch out the the projects, the CEO at the end of the 2-week period, which was just fascinating. Mm. And it gave me the confidence because I owned that. It was mine.
Mm.
And it gave me the confidence at that point to think, I could run my own business. I could do my own thing. And it was from that I made that decision after my role was made redundant in 2018 officially. I'd gone on maternity leave the year before, and that was the turning point. That was when I started my business.
And now you are one of the leading trainers in our industry, thankfully. I love all your posts on LinkedIn. Like, it's a
thank you. Yeah, I have a lot to say on LinkedIn, all my platforms. But I love LinkedIn. It's a great space.
Yeah. We have a lot to say LinkedIn on the podcast. But tell us a bit about what you do in terms of the training with assistants and...
Yeah. So I specialize in helping executive assistants, experienced executive assistants, further progress their roles into higher level roles. Mm. Whether that be into an executive business partner type role, it could be into an HR manager role, it could be into a project officer, project communications officer. Another client of mine's just doing that move transition at the moment. Junior chief of staff. One client's gone into a consultant role, so completely out of the admin space. Another client's starting up a yoga studio. Another client's moving into an executive coaching role. So the clients that I work with, there's not one career path. And I hope by me rattling off those titles there, I can help everyone listening that there's more to your career progression than a potential chief of staff role. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with the chief of staff role. It is a very different role than an EA role. But there are so many different options out there.
I know, so and it's a bit bizarre because in the UK we've had this obsession all year of chief of staff is the next step, and we've talked about it on a couple of previous episodes, and it's not the absolute next step for every assistant. And in fact, you talk to a lot of employers here, they don't think it is either. I don't know why we've got this sort of obsession over here that it is the absolute for every single assistant.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of especially a lot of Silicon Valley US-based, organisations have adopted the kind of chief of staff roles, which are, kind of like a hybrid between EA and a true chief of staff role. So there's a bit of, a difference, but, like EA roles, no EA role is the same. It's the same for chief of staff role, right? So it's so different and in different organisations and different industries as well.
Yeah.
So... I just want assistants to know that if they do desire career progression, the world is their oyster.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I shared a post on LinkedIn recently that, I am there are executive assistants out there that I want to be executive assistants for life. It is a career for life. And that is amazing. And I always say to assistants, if you want to be a career, you love your role, you love what you do, do it for life and do it well. Yeah. Because the world needs fantastic assistants. Yeah. But if you are equally an assistant that does desire something more, you want further career progression, that is also okay. And there's so much out there for you. So I think there needs to be an increased narrative that you can do either. Yes. And there's nothing wrong with either.
And there's nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. Ruth, I couldn't agree more. And I do think you talk about transferable skills. There are many directions that assistants can go in. I mean, one day, one of my executives said to me, I want you to lead this project. And I thought, our first initial response is, oh, my goodness, me. And then she explained to me, but you are already managing everything in my office. You're managing everything end to end. You already speak to people in different levels of the organization. You already get production from people without positional power. She's like, you were built for this. You've got the experience for this. But assistants kind of, I think, if you're one of those people who looks at the next challenge and says, I want to break out into something else, just know that you've got an assembly of usable tools, transferable skills, things that will stand you in good stead. I always encourage assistants, have a specialization, you know, above what you do as an assistant, have something, a party piece, have something that you really lean into, whether it's in your comms team, in your HR team, pick up those little projects, start getting involved. You know, if you're looking for progression, you did a beautiful thing. I put my hand up and I said, can I do it? And you got that opportunity because you were brave enough to step up and ask. I think a lot of people sit back and wait for an opportunity, and others make opportunities. So just know that you've got that skill set, lean into it, prepare yourself for the next step. And, you know, it's so lovely to hear that you've got people transitioning into all kinds of spheres.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. And fascinating, actually. One of my clients, she works for Google in the US. I've been working with her one-to-one, and she came to me and said, Ruth, I want chief of staff. And I'm like, okay, like very defiant. And I do a lot of clarity work, exploration work with clients, both in my one-to-one and group programs, and helping to get a little more clarity around what it is they actually enjoy doing. Because a title, yes, you know, some people it's really significant importance, others it's not so much. But strip the title away for a moment, what is it we actually enjoy working on day to day? Because that is what's going to light you up each day and make you open your laptop from home or go to the office each day. And so we did a bit of exploration work, and some stuff came up through that exercise that I, you know, hadn't been mentioned before. And she said, oh, that's interesting, you know, about coaching people and teaching people. Anyway, I didn't press her on that, but a couple months into our working relationship, she said, Ruth, it's come really clear now. I want to, not the chief of staff, I want to go into executive coaching. And so we've pivoted, which is obviously something I've done and walked the path myself. So I'm now helping her start her coaching business. So, what that looks like, transitioning away from corporate. So it's, yeah, really, really exciting to work with her on that. Really exciting. And she's got huge potential. So
it's, it's made me think, before the pandemic, one of EPA's members said, Vic, I'm not renewing my membership. I was too frightened to tell you, but I'm stepping out of the PA role. And it made me have a big, I said, oh, well, congratulations, I'm over the moon. She was going into HR and you know, I was really happy for her. But I realised the narrative from people like me and the industry was, this is a job for life, and for the next 40 to 50 years of you working, no retirement for these generations, you're going to be a PA forever. And I realised, I look back at some of my previous presentations, and that's the message I was sort of giving out. And even though I hadn't gone that direction myself, so it was a kind of a bit of a wake-up call. And I said, oh, I feel bad that you felt frightened to tell me that you were stepping out the PA role. But it's happening so much now. And this is why, you know, we're running this virtual panel next week on former assistants and what they've gone on to do, and that's what I want EPA to be there for assistants in the UK for as long as they're in the profession. And that might be a year, that might be 10 years, but it's probably not going to be for 40-50 years. And so that's why we're changing all that now in the narrative as a professional body.
You know, Vic, the narrative has changed globally about careers. You know, people don't stay with a company for 30 years and get their gold watch. You will, I mean, I think the current research is you'll have like 4 careers in your lifetime. You know, so we also need to, as an industry, embrace that people will come and go. And I always say to people, consider an EA role if you're really serious about business. You get management training for free. You've got a front row seat, bring your popcorn. You know, here you can physically see it in action. And I learn by seeing, having that executive level experience, seeing how they work through problems and sometimes how they treat people and sometimes how not to treat people. You know, you learn the positives and the negatives, but that was highly translatable into my business. You know, to know what the principles are. You cannot, there is no degree that's going to give you this kind of hands-on training. Mm-hmm. So I always encourage people
who
have big business dreams, go for this. This is where you can really get skills that will serve you in the long term and get you exposure. I mean, we deal with the board, with the executives, with all the high-level clients. You know, you don't get that in a middle management role. I'm dealing with like the top people. So I think people don't sell that portion of the profession.
Yeah.
I highly respect, you know, just if it's a stepping stone for you, just be respectful of the profession and use it to its full capacity and add maximum value. Mm-hmm. I don't like people who kind of, you know, end up in the role and just fluff around, you know, sort of float around until the next thing comes along. If you're there, just maximize the opportunity.
Oh, look, I think anyway in the profession, especially right now, if people float around, they're not going to last.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you're not going to last in a role anyway. So, you know, I 100% agree with you now. You know, I think I quite frequently say, you know, if you want an MBA, be an executive assistant. It is a living and breathing MBA. Mm-hmm. It's just how you need to be able to utilize it and see it through that lens. And be able to utilize the conversations, the exposure to opportunities within that that role. Yeah, I mean, you have access to so many people, different areas of the business,
and so much information.
Learn from. Yeah,
which leads nicely onto, and in fact, we should probably go into this now about the L&D side of our industry, which I know we're all passionate about, and we caused a bit of controversy on one of our recent episodes because. And now, I mean, I know I was coined the term of the year, wash, rinse and repeat. I just love it so much. I don't love that that's happening in our industry, but it it up really nicely. But do you think, like, what we're talking about now and hearing from you both, because there's a big lack of confidence in a lot of assistants at the moment, not getting the stretch, do you think some of the L&D in our industry is perhaps holding people back? And I mean, how do you put it, that kind of lack of growth mindset, but it's tied in with confidence, and it just feels quite icky at the moment to me.
Yeah, I actually, before I came to this podcast, I posted a message to my private clients to ask for their insights, and it was, I mean, I have my opinions about it, but I wanted to just hear from them in terms of their words, which completely echoed mine. They feel that, and this is, I guess, why what I do has been so well received, is that there is no coaching, training, formalized training, or very little in that middle ground for assistants. If they don't want to be in the executive assistant role, then how and where do they go from there, and how can they get that support? There is, you know, easily a sign off for L&D when you're an assistant, but when there's that middle ground, you know, want to progress into another role, there's not this understanding isn't there, and there's not enough resources there, you know, in all different areas. And there's an also to your point as well, people don't understand that assistance or how to develop them. And what they don't understand, they want to progress. And, but what do you want to do? What does that look like? And, of course, executive assistants don't know what options are open to them. There's just this big, vast nothing gaping with executives, and HR leaders don't know how to development, and assistants don't know what are their options are. So there's this big gaping, big hole, which, you know, obviously is very frustrating, very frustrating. So I think we need to do more in that space. Absolutely. You know, I would get people reaching out to me on LinkedIn pretty much daily saying, you know, I didn't know someone like you existed to help people like us do that, you know, make this transition. You know, I've been, you know, banging my head against the wall. I don't know what to do. I've got degrees, I've got an MBA, I've done this course, I've got this certification, I've got a list, the long, you know, length of my arm, you know, of all these qualifications, and nothing has budged. No one knows what to do with me. I don't know what, you know, where I need to go. Highly educated, very intelligent, smart business professionals that have extreme potential to do tremendous things in business and are highly passionate about the businesses they work for. Mm. So passionate, like it just blows my mind, like that management is not even seeing right under their noses a truly highly engaged, passionate business professional right then and there that is going to help support and drive their business forward and is quite happy to move into any role that is open to them.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that we need to do more in that space, in the in-between helping assistants. Mm. Now, it is a bigger challenge to get organizations to do the work. And as anyone knows me well for my content, following me on LinkedIn, I don't point fingers. I take responsibility. I'm a big advocate for taking responsibility ourselves. And you, if you want change, you need to stand up and take change yourself and make the change. So that's why obviously I encourage my clients, I teach them how to lead their own development.
Yeah.
How to go about those discussions.
Yeah.
You know, how to have those just development discussions that are actually not going to be, as I said, quite commonly we used to get the comment of, doing a good job, Ruth, keep doing what you're doing, every performance review. So how to avoid those kind of conversations so they're actually meaningful and they go somewhere.
Yeah.
So I'm very passionate about filling that gap, and I think that we need to do better there.
Mm.
And I think we also need to be really, I don't know why we're not talking about this, and that is more in the industry, is that we have an aging population of leaders.
Mm.
And I'm getting increasing comments from assistants that my executive doesn't know how to use an assistant.
Mm.
They say they don't need an assistant. They don't want an assistant.
Mm.
And it's not that they don't need or want an assistant, it's that they don't know how to use an assistant. Mm. And I think the aging population, that, you know, the new generation of leaders coming through, they're more tech savvy. Mm. They know how to quickly, you know, sort out tech themselves. They know how to manage their emails, where the older generation would rely very heavily on their assistants for their tech.
Mm.
So I think there needs to be more on how to really help assistants and executives to form different partnerships going forward.
Absolutely.
And how to work powerfully together going forward in a different world, right?
You know, Ruth, I think the something that resonated so much with me from what you were saying, I've worked for one of those younger managers. And we had this exact discussion. I don't need you. You've been assigned to me. And, you know, I kind of gave it a little while, sucked it all out, and then found where I could add value. What could I take off her plate? How could I make the time that she's got available that she can really work in her zone of genius?
Mm.
And suddenly she was like, okay, now I get it. But I assumed that she didn't want me because she knows what I do. She didn't know what I can do. She and working with those managers, you can actually create that job, but you've got to teach them, and you've got to also involve yourself where you can see them getting into the weeds. You've got to say, listen, this is an Anel thing. This is not a you thing. I can manage this for you. You can focus on something else. So there's a level of assertiveness that also comes into it. And I often said to her, you know, I am like an external hard drive. Whatever's in your head, let's reduce the load. Spread the load. You know, that the mental pressure, the running the to-do lists, the following up with a team, that managing on your behalf, because they spend so much time in meetings. Mm-hmm. And that's where I found that was where the value was. But for each person, you said a very true thing. You're going to have to look at what's in your environment and maximize on what you see there But I always look at people like that as a huge challenge and an exciting challenge, because you can make that role your own. They don't have very predefined ideas of what you should be doing. If you can add value somewhere, they open that door for you. And if they don't open that door for you, ask yourself if you're in the right place.
100%. Yeah. I quite frequently, very frequently hear of assistants that are unhappy with their roles, and they're being mistreated or spoken to, they're not happy. I know times are challenging at the moment in the workforce, but, you know, get out there and have a look what else is out there. And to your earlier point, Anil, about niching, one of the two areas that I really think that assistants, I suggest anyone listening, if you're wanting to, focus in your development going forward, and that is, and I don't think enough of, especially virtual assistants, is niching and looking at, really, if you enjoy, for example, if you enjoy media, if that's your thing, your industry, really focusing on roles in that industry. And secondly, communicating, so learning how to really sell and market your value. And if you, the power of niching and then communicating your value effectively of your experience and skill set in that industry, it makes you a formidable force.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I have had two clients recently, just one last week, she has doubled her salary. She has just gone into a new, about a strategic business partner equivalent role from an EA role. But the money wasn't a focus. She was passionate, really passionate about that industry, really passionate about that role. And she had fantastic experience. We worked on, how she articulated that value and how she in written and spoken form. So when she went into that interview, coupled with her passion for that industry, excitement, it was a no-brainer to hire her. No-brainer at all. And her ideas and how to work in partnership with the executive, it's a match made in heaven. So, and it's another client, because the same thing's happened as well. Passion for that role, excitement for that industry, coupled with, a really clearly communicated value, is really, really formidable.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Ruth, I just keep coming back to a common thread that keeps popping up in my head is, I think a lot of the struggle, a lot of the challenge is, if assistants tend to be these exceptional generalists, I can do everything that I put my hands on. So do you find that it's harder for them to zone in and focus on, or pick a focus area? Because I know that from my own career, I'm interested in everything and I'll putter around with everything, and everything is figure outable. So getting to that niche, getting to that narrow focus where you can really make an impact. Have you found that with your clients, that's the journey? Once that clicks into place, a lot of other dominoes fall.
Yeah. So what I do, the exercise in terms of clarity with my clients, we pull out a lot of stuff from their past. And I'll give you my past example. And I did this exercise myself and found it really, really powerful. And that was kind of brainstorming my past careers and brainstorming things that were just really lit my soul, in terms of really excited me. And things that came up, like, for example, I was doing executive assistant conference speaking for 6 years throughout my career. And I just knew that was something that I should keep doing. And I enjoyed it. I didn't know what would become of it, if anything. I just followed that through. I was running workshops, like time management workshops in my lunch break at GE, just for the fun of it. So coaching and teaching people things that were just so obvious. If you look, that I just looked back on things that really I enjoyed, just fit perfectly into what I do now.
The pattern, yeah.
It's ridiculous.
But
there is
a pattern, and I think when you take the time to really think about what makes you happy. I mean, and also the intentionality. You know, a couple of years ago, I said to my husband, one day I will travel the world. And working on my EA salary in South Africa, he said to me, how on earth are you going to do that? And hey presto, 2 years later, I was on a plane every 2 months to a different country. And he said to me, you are scary when you say, this is what I'm going to do. I think that intentionality, when you make a decision, it's not a, you know, one of those fluffy goals you set for the future where it's an intention and you say, this is what I'm going to do. That also changes the game significantly. Have you found that in your experience?
I'm definitely one of these people that if I say I'm going to do something, I do it. Yeah. And, you know, clients always ask me that, you know, because I ask a lot of questions before, you know, clients come to work with me. And I'm often asked by clients, you know, what is it that you look for, Ruth? And I say it's tenacity, because growth isn't an upward, you know, an upward scale. It's up, down, flat, down, up, down. It's all over the place. Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to ride the waves. You need to be able to ride the waves, because otherwise, it's going to stand still.
Yeah, I had a slightly different driver. I was made redundant pretty early on in my career, and that was a good thing for me as well. But what I realised coming out of college was this whole job for life notion that had been sold to everybody else before me, I realised it weren't happening. And then I realised the longevity of companies. You know, you're not going to see companies around for 100 years in the future. Probably not. You know, things that when we got into much more of a global economy, I realised how much more fragile the UK economy was, and seeing that in the recession as well. And that was the driver for me. I was different to some of my peer group here, because they assumed that they were safe just because they were a PA. And I was like, but what else can I do to add real value? And I was doing that from such a young age, but most of my peer group at the time weren't. And the driver was me, is what, you know, what's going to keep me employable. And then when I went into group HR as an EA, I then saw how vulnerable this population was in terms of restructure and redundancies, and how actually we were doing it to ourselves as well. Like I've said it before, and it's horrible to say it, but it was easy pickings.
Yeah.
You know, I've sat in group HR, we made thousands of people redundant worldwide. The admins were the easiest to get shot of.
Yes. Yeah. It's always the low-hanging fruit. What I always find ironic in South Africa, they cull the whole group, and then they hand pick a whole bunch back. So it's almost a yo-yo effect. They think they can do without.
Yeah.
Then they have to bring half of them back at higher salaries. So, you know, and again, the top level EAs benefit from that. You know, they are smiling all the way to the bank. They walk into their next job. They can pick their next job. And I also think it's sort of cherry picking the best back into the business. Yeah. So if you're not adding that value, you won't be cherry picked back in.
Yeah.
Something that you said, Ruth, that really also struck my attention was, if you're in an environment, an easy way to find that specialization or to find something where you can add value is to look for problems. I'm one of those people who is super excited about problems. And I know this is like so counterintuitive, but the second I see a problem, I firmly believe there must be a solution. And I see that as an opportunity, not as a problem. So I think if we are as assistants, part of the job scope is that you are a master level problem solver. You should be seeking out bigger problems. When you see that there's a consistent pattern, go and look for the root cause, get involved, because I think that's a very easy way to find your niche. Just being curious, getting involved, putting up your hand.
Yeah. I would go once above and say again, and saying having a look at what's a priority in the business right now, because you know, if you know, so for example, the filing is a complete mess. You know, if you redo the filing, it's going to be absolutely appreciated. You're absolutely going to get a pat on the back. You're absolutely, everyone's going to be loving you. But is it business critical at the moment? Yeah. It might not be in this quarter, right? So they're probably not going to get the recognition that it deserves.
Mm.
So it's about working smart, not hard.
Yeah.
So positioning yourself and how you deliver that value, you know, is it aligned with what the business is trying to achieve? Mm. And if you can position yourself, you know, in an area that is a key deliverable for the business, for example, that project initiative I ran, it was a key driving deliverable for the GE Australia overarching goals for that year, like that to go up to the American, you know, to the US. So it was imperative that I got that right. So I was a big cog in that wheel. So I felt I could see the impact of my value real time, what was happening. So this is why I'm so passionate about that, because I can see in how that value and
springboard.
Positioning in the right way and can really be very, very impactful.
Mm. You know, Ruth, I always say to people, there's a couple of cliches in our profession. And a cliche becomes a cliche because it's true. We do need to be strategic. We do still have operational things to do. Somewhere in the middle is what I'd like to talk about, being completely tactical, knowing what to do and getting the operational things done, but integrating those, because we always talk about the strategic as if it's standing completely on its own.
No, it's operational stuff,
you know, and what you're talking about now is looking at that whole thing, understanding the strategy, understanding your own personal strategy. What am I trying to achieve? How can I make sure that I'm profiling my skill set and addressing the operational? So that's completely one of the most beautiful examples I've heard of how you work in a more tactical way, you know, integrating business
knowledge. It's completely integrated. It's not a separate thing.
Exactly. And I must tell you that I think that's a narrative that we also need to explore on or have language for, because we keep talking about this, you know, strategy, great. I understanding and doing are two different things. Taking the understanding you have and making an impact with it, that's why I always talk about in that tactical gap, where we bring all of it together, that is where you can really shine. And I think you've given so many examples of where you've positioned yourself to be tactical. And I think that's something we should really work towards.
And to your point about theory-based, you know, I'm huge. I'm really, really big on, you know, making sure we take action with the theory. And, you know, there is so much consumption of information in learning development, not just in learning, you know, in the admin profession, but in all professions, there's so much information there. And I think there's a really big misconception out there that watching or listening or reading something where I've learned something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, you haven't. That's just the first lens. The second lens is you need to go and implement it so you gain skills and experience in that area. And this is why I'm such a big advocate. People will hear me me blab on about it on LinkedIn, is that I'm a huge advocate for traditional learning development, but it needs to be the right time and place.
Mm.
And I'm a really good example of that. I have a business management degree. Great. I didn't use jack of that.
Until now.
Until now. However, I've forgotten it all. Why? Because I didn't implement what I had learnt and at the same time. Now, I have clients at the moment who have gone into HR roles and now they are studying HR. Perfect time. Perfect time. Because you can implement real time that theory. And it makes sense. It's able to digest and it will resonate and you'll be able to return the information. And it's more valuable because you're able to get the experience, so therefore communicate the value.
And also, Ruth, you make such a valid point that, I mean, I always say to people in my workshops, especially the longer workshops, pick something that you are going to implement from Monday morning, because we all get back from a workshop. We're very excited. We have good intentions. We chuck the file in the bottom of the drawer. The email starts up. The phone starts up. And 6 months later, you're tidying your desk and out comes the file. So if you've got the intention, if you've learned something valuable from that webinar, from that workshop you attended, if you don't at least take one small actionable thing, you will take no action at all. And yeah. you will not embed that learning. So I think that is also something. And I think people are in this constant consumption mode. But consumption, you've got the information, but you don't have knowledge. You don't have skill until it starts going through that practical filter where you physically work with it.
Yeah. Yeah,
the rest absolutely. Is like watching TV. You can put on Netflix. Yeah. Great. You know, if it's not coming into the real world, it has that much impact on yeah. your career. So it's not how much you do. It's mm-hmm. how much you do that you physically implement.
Absolutely.
This whole L&D's kind of discussion leads very nicely on to conferences and training days and things like that. And something I think we should probably talk about, because I put quite an impassioned post last week on LinkedIn about the late, great Susie Baron Stubley. And I opened up a little bit about what has been going on behind the scenes with our industry. And I knew it wasn't going to be very palatable for assistants, but I felt they actually did need to know that it is quite a widespread problem now. And it kind of ties into, assistants being able to attend a conference or a training day and getting absolute maximum impact, really high value from us as trainers or speakers. And I don't think that's always been the case. And I think that traces back to it's been a little bit cardboard cutouts and crayons, you know, throwing agendas together, not paying speakers and trainers. And I think if we can build a more ethical industry in terms of in that respect, I think it will help us all. It will help assistants. Assistants will go to a conference and know they're getting the best level content. When I'm asked to do something for free, I'm not going to give you my top content. I'm not. I'm going to give you bare bones, if that. And I said in that post, I've had over 3,000 requests this year, and we're not even done yet. For free memberships, free coaching, free training. And I know some of that is lack of confidence. They can't, there are some assistants, I can't get any budget. My boss doesn't value me, my company, I can't afford it myself. You know, we've got a cost of living crisis, but this has actually been going on for years, some of this stuff. And so I wanted to touch on it. I think, also in Susie's memory as well, but to make sure that we build this really from every angle, a robust and strong profession and industry, and that we're all valued, not just assistants, but the expertise we've got as well and that we're giving out. And I put, like Susie, I do apportion some of my expertise for free, and that goes to genuinely disadvantaged people now. You know, people who really, I know that they're absolute rock bottom and there's nowhere to go for them. I've had a lot of private messages over the last week, as well as a big response to the post as well. But I know it's an icky subject to bring up, but I felt we have to bring it up now.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I know for a lot of assistants, conferences are really pretty much the only L&D they attend each year. And there are some phenomenal conferences out there. And I've spoken at many, and a lot of them in Australia here and also internationally as well, both physical but also in person, but also virtual as well. So there are some fantastic conferences out there. My encouragement to assistants who do attend conferences is, one, look at what you want out of a learning development experience. Mm. And ask yourself, what is it that you want out of it? And does that conference, is it going to help benefit you? Or are you just attending this conference because all your colleagues or friends are attending this? Mm. Yes, it is nice. And I understand the assistant profession can be so damn isolating, and it's really nice to connect with assistants. But if that's your only L&D budget that you get each year, think about it, because times are changing at the moment, really changing, and for the profession, and just think really smart about your decisions and the conference you attend, and make sure that aligns with what you want. Secondly, I think a lot of assistants don't realize that a lot of the speakers at a lot of these conferences aren't paid.
Mm-hmm.
I know for me now, I when I first started conferences, I didn't realize this, and I certainly wasn't paid. But now for a number of years now, I if you see me speaking at an event, I'm a paid speaker, or there's an appropriate, there's an appropriate agreement there, alternative agreement. And there are conference organizations out there like yourself, Victoria, that, you know, it's front and center in terms of investing in their speakers. And it is due to really careful curation of the program that you genuinely care about what content people are coming to listen to. Mm-hmm. And the speakers are going to be impactful and the audience is going to get value.
Absolutely.
Now, I understand, you know, many assistants are like myself. I started that as a public speaking exercise and I just loved it. It was really great. But I think from that, you know, organizations really need to provide assistance, even if they are, you know, they're coming free of charge, to provide a suitable alternative in terms of, if it's not monetary, something else to show appreciation and recognition for that assistant sharing their IP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, Ruth, I think there's another layer to this as well. You know, I don't mind coming in to speak to your PA forum. But if you are a massive international or national company with budget, the fact that I'm now being approached and the expectation is that I should do it for free means one of two things to me. You don't have the confidence to go and ask for budgets, okay? But you all the alternative is you don't respect me enough to go and ask for the budget. So, and what horrifies me is that I know certain PA forum leaders teaching other PA forums how to get speakers for free. So this is not only something that's happening with conferences, and I think that's something that also needs to be addressed. You know, the time that you invest, I seriously, when I prepare for an event, I really do my homework. I invest that time. I try to give you maximum value. But just that I have noticed that there's now this business model that's spreading. Why should we pay for people to come and give us quality if we can just get everything for free? Which, you know, much like you, Ruth, I've now started pushing back and saying certain things I cannot give you for free. If I do a YouTube video that you put onto your channel, I can take that same YouTube or that same webinar and I can sell it to my clients. I'm not giving away for free anymore. And like Vic also said, there are always exceptions where you really can help somebody and you really can move the needle. But there is also this devaluation of the skill sets that trainers and coaches and you bring to the table. So I think that also needs to be addressed in a wider sense.
I can give you a good story here. So this was before the pandemic. I spoke at a trade show right here, and it was like an hour session, and one of the PAs said to me afterwards, well, I enjoyed it, but you could have given us a lot more. And I said to her, you do realize that I'm here free of charge and this trade show hasn't even paid my travel. And she was like, what? And I said, no, we have to apply to even speak here. We have to apply and we don't get our travel paid for because apparently I'm lucky to be here. And she was like, I didn't realize. And I was like,
exposure does not pay the bills.
Yes,
folks.
It doesn't. Yeah. And I kind of, you know, it was the anniversary of last week with Susie. And that's, I kind of felt I'm not going to hold back from this stuff anymore because I feel, you know, we need assistants of value themselves. We need assistants of value, the expertise and the training. And the way I work at EPA is, frankly, we have a lot less budget. We're not for profit. We have a lot less budget than the PA networks who are all profit making, which is fine. No problem with that. And the international conferences, they've got huge budgets and they've got sponsors as well. And so it doesn't resonate with me why, as a not-for-profit, I managed to find an honorarium for my speakers. I don't understand why they can't do that. And so the way I work with EPA is, yes, we do offer a payment. And if it's a PA panel, we don't pay PAs because that's not, they're not professional trainers and speakers. You know, you both are. So if you're coming to speak at an EPRA event, whether that's virtual or face-to-face, this is your livelihood and this is now your career. If you're a PA, getting up on stage, as I did like over 1,000 events as a PA, getting up on panels and sharing my career story. I wasn't qualified as a professional speaker or trainer or coach. I didn't have private indemnity insurance. So what I do, you know, with the panels, I cover all their expenses, travel expenses. They get a free ticket to be there at the whole day of the conference. And then what we've just started doing is saying, I will make a small donation to a charity of your choice. Mm. And they've all got their personal charities. Yeah. And that's the way I operate. And I'm very upfront about that. But this is why I don't speak at many PA events now, because I'm so over it now. People expecting me to give up my time for free, pay my travel. Like, I'm done. I've done my bit. And,
you know, I think, I don't know if any of you feel the same way, but it kind of came to a head during COVID.
Mm.
You know, I had 3 years worth of bookings ahead of time and they started falling like dominoes. And I still had people hitting me up for free stuff, where I was literally trying to survive this period with no income, no idea what happens next. And I think to me, that was the point where I realized this had been fine in normal business, normal times. I hadn't noticed that this was a trend. I think for me, it all came to a head there. But just coming back to, I think if I could ask the assistants listening to this, this is what I would ask you to do. When you sign up for an L&D conference, ask the conference organizer, are your speakers paid? It's that simple, you know? And if you feel okay with paying a very high ticket price, knowing that the speakers are not paid, that's great, that's on you. But I think if you have an ethical dilemma with this, it's a very simple question. You simply ask, is the panel compensated? You know, and I think just having that awareness and having those discussions with organizers will put the spotlight back onto these people should be paid for their time.
Yeah. And look, I think they should be absolutely asking that question from a quality perspective, you know, in terms of back to my point earlier, you know, if that's their only L&D in, you know, investment they can make each year, you know, that's a really smart question to ask. So they know in terms of quality of content they're going to be receiving. I also come from, you know, the angle that, you know, the industry as a whole, as admin professions, we're really fighting for increased salaries and recognition. So this is just the same in terms of making sure that educators in this space are recognized and and compensated accordingly. Mm. And it just emphasized, we're just obviously self-feeding this if other assistants are supporting educators not being. It needs to be addressed because I really think though, like myself, I didn't realize that speakers weren't being paid when I was, you know, speaking. I just thought as an assistant, I was just, because I was an assistant at the time and not a professional speaker, because I thought, you know, no, I don't get any payment. They would cover other costs for me, but I wasn't aware that other speakers weren't, professional speakers weren't getting paid.
I wasn't either until Susie raised it with me. And I remember a heartbreaking conversation with Susie and she told me how bad it was getting. Now, when Susie first set up her business, it wasn't an issue. She was never asked. This was something that came along later on. Yeah. And I guess you could say it was when my brand as a PA was peaking. I was literally on every conference platform in the UK and trade show. And she said to me, we were having a glass of wine, and she said that it was becoming a struggle to earn a living. And she said, I need people like you to start charging. And I said, but I can't. Like, Hayes wouldn't let me anyway, because I was a PA sharing my story. I wasn't a professional speaker. And she said, because the problem is now conference platforms and event platforms, are filling up with people like you who are not professionally trained to do it, sharing stories, they're making money out of you, and therefore it's becoming increasingly difficult for me to make money. And I kind of got it, but I said to her, but I'm not, you know, I'm just a PA sharing my story. Like, I'm, you know, I'm giving some top tips, but I'm not you. I'm, you know, I wasn't qualified to train PAs at that. That came later on. And I didn't, I guess I fully, a lot of reflection after her passing, and it, and then becoming, you know, a trainer and coach myself. And I was like, oh my God, you know, and I think the best thing I can do for her legacy, because I totally get it now. Now that I'm in her space, and I have been for quite a while, I totally get what she was trying to say to me. But then I didn't fully understand it at the time. I was riding off the waves of, I'm sharing my story, I hope it helps. And it had a massive, massive impact on her mental health. I mean, you know, she lost everything in the end. And she said what she was competing with is people who weren't, you know, people like me, who were PAs sharing their stories, and these conference platforms been full of it because we were free. And, you know, and
they always say, why would you buy the milk if you can get, or why would you buy the cow if you can get the milk for free? I don't know if that translates in all the different time zones this morning, but, you know, and I do think that a lot of companies have now built that as a business model, and they're teaching other organizations to do the same. And sometimes you do feel a bit defenseless against the onslaught, but I've made a decision. I'd rather not work in the PA space if this is the business model. So, you know, if you are operating ethically and you respect my time, I'm not dealing with people who want things for exposure. After more than a decade of international training, I think I'm okay on exposure. You know, exposure hasn't paid my rent, so, you know, I tried to exchange that exposure at the shop for milk, but, you know, that didn't work either. So I think people just need to maintain their boundaries. So, you know, if, like, most important thing, ask the questions. Like Ruth quite rightly said, it does impact quality. It does impact who they can get for free. So if it is free, you know, are they getting the people from the bench, or are they getting the A team in? Ask the questions. I think just the awareness, just having this discussion today and just putting the cards on the table. Some EA out there listening to this podcast was blissfully unaware, and this has been happening in the shadows. So it's time to speak truth to power.
It's also what Ruth touched upon as well. You know, we all just start valuing each other. Admins value themselves and assistants, and you value
We can't team. Back each other. Who can we know?
Yeah, exactly.
And are we going to change this narrative if we don't change it ourselves?
Yeah, and having an ethical industry and profession going forward will only make us stronger, and you'll get that top quality content that you want. You won't come away from a conference thinking, oh, well, that was nice, but was it really worth the day out the office, which does happen a lot. You know, I hear a lot of assistants say that. And that's why I work really, really hard on my conference programs and the content that, you know, I don't ever theme my conferences, as you both know. I don't put a theme on it. I want to go in and out of topics and, you know, really get their minds working and thinking about a lot of different things. But that's the one thing I want to do positively with Susie's legacy, is to make sure that we are, you know, ethical going forward, that assistants are getting that top level content, that we're really helping to drive their careers forward. But we cannot do that on fresh air. And so, yeah, I want to spin it into a real positive, and I think we can do that as a profession, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
The late, great Susie. I'm going to be sharing a lot more of some of Susie's kind of trainings over the next couple of years, because I've got all of it. But I've been doing it with some assistants here, because she was just amazing. I wish you'd got to meet her, Ruth. She was just an incredible.
She sounds lovely.
Oh, you would have loved her. She loved Australia as well, didn't she, and the Australian assistants. I know she trained over there more than a couple of times, actually. So thinking about your entire career, and you've had an exceptional, you know, you've made some really shrewd strategic moves. I've absolutely loved listening to your story today. But are there any kind of lessons learned, anything you wish you'd done differently, any kind of coulda, woulda, shoulda moments?
Yeah, look, If there's any kind of I wish I'd done things differently, it was I wish I had asked more questions. I had shared, like asked more questions, you know, in the very early stages of my career, and been more inquisitive. Mm-hmm. And that definitely came, you know, in the second half of my career, in full strides. But I wish I'd, you know, asked more questions and got more involved in the business a lot earlier on. And that would have helped me to fast track and see my positioning a lot earlier, I believe. But I believe that everything happens for a reason in terms of timing, and certainly mine, you know, my role being made redundant towards the end of my career was just that perfect nudge for me to kind of go, you know, like now's the time. But if I don't, you know, if it doesn't happen now, it's never going to happen. So, yeah. So it was a, you know, I don't live with any regrets.
Yeah. And yeah. If you had one tip, if you could sprinkle fairy dust on every EA listening to this podcast today and change one thing for them, or just have one little piece of wisdom that drops for them, what would you leave them with?
I would have to say, communicate. Tell if you want to progress or further develop, whether you're in, you know, expand your capability in your existing assistant role and that's where you want to stay, communicate where you want to expand. If you want to progress further, communicate your desire for development. It is quite fascinating and just shocks me every time how fast things can happen for assistants' careers when they simply have a conversation. It's quite sometimes it's as simple as having a conversation. So, you know, don't be shy in coming forward and advocating for yourself, because there's certainly no one else that's going to advocate for your career and development as much as you are.
Ruth, it's absolutely amazing that you said that. I often say in workshops, you are one conversation away from better outcomes. Yeah. You are holding yourself back from that conversation. If I ask, I'm in with a 50% shot, okay? Yeah. Even if they shoot me down and they say, no, I had a 50% shot. Yeah. If you don't ask, your failure rate is 100%. So that really resonated with me. And if I think back on my career, things changed for me when I spoke up, when I asked the questions, when I, you know, was nosy and put my hand up or got involved, stepped out of my comfort zone, because nothing magical happens if you stay in that bubble. So that's, that really, really resonates.
Mm. And take a look around you, you know, at the three of us, you know, Jessica, and there's amazing coaches here in Australia, educators, like, there's, and around the world, there are some amazing former assistants and current assistants that have got, you know, really amazing side hustles and businesses doing some fantastic things. So there's so much opportunity and inspiration out there for you to look to in terms of what could be possible.
Definitely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. It's been it's amazing start to my day, that's for sure. I know it's evening for you now, Ruth, but honestly, it's been a huge pleasure to have you on today. And I know the assistants are going to get a lot from listening to this conversation. And I'm really excited to meet you in person next year in Bonnie.
Yeah, I can't wait. It'll be great.
Bonnie Scotland.
A whole year to wait.
I know. Yeah, it's going to be super exciting. I'm really, really looking forward to 2024, actually. I think 2023 has been a tricky year for many reasons, cost of living, inflation, and obviously all the stuff that's going on in the world right now. So I'm not wishing the rest of the year away, or perhaps I am, but yeah, I'm really looking forward to 2024. So thank you very much. Thank you for joining this episode of the Assistant Lab. If you enjoyed this content, you know what you need to do. Feel free to share it and help us grow our subscriber base.
Join us again next time. And until then, keep experimenting, innovating, and improving your skill sets.